We're going to look at a topic that actually got started by a dinner time conversation the other night, last week. A few of the family members caught Dennis Prager's radio show. He's a fairly recent addition to the local commentators that have come onto the radio. And he has an interesting section is called the Ultimate Issues Hour. Now, most of the time, I like Dennis Prager's show because you don't usually find commentators who are willing to address moral issues from a biblical standpoint. He's a conservative Jew in his background. And what's interesting is that he will actually bring up in his radio show times like, for instance, Bible verses and then have that as a discussion for a whole hour. And most of the time he's fairly logical. Most of the time he does a decent job with teaching things that are reasonable, even if I may not always agree with them. But on this particular topic and on this day, he did a really poor job. I didn't catch the show. I just heard it from the boys, and the wife also heard him. And talking about what he said, it was odd. Because the contention that he was bringing up is that what's morally right or what's morally wrong is based on the situation. It's a form of situation ethics. What he basically claimed is that in any situation, there is an absolute right choice, but it doesn't remain fixed for all situations, which is an interesting variation. In other words, what's wrong in many situations might become right in a particular situation. Now, just to define the term so you understand what's being talked about here, there is an idea in when we're making choices, there's this approach to saying that there's choices to be made. There's the idea of absolute morality. That is, there is a fixed standard of what's right and wrong, regardless of the context, regardless of how consequences are there, or the intentions of the person. You don't consider any of those things. There is a right and a wrong, and that's absolute morality. The standard of it is independent of the customs of a person. It's independent of the person's opinion. We're talking about that there is this is either right or this is wrong. Now, most of us look at it and say that's what Christianity teaches. And that's what I would say, that that's what the Bible teaches. There's another idea that goes to the other end of the spectrum almost. And that is the idea of moral relativism. There, the standard of right or wrong changes by the individual, or possibly by a societal group. In other words, what might be right for you might not be right for me. It's a claim that there isn't an absolute or a universal standard for everyone. Everybody has their own standards. And actually, that's probably the most common type of judgments that are being made in the world today. And the reason why I can say that is everyone who claims that it's wrong to judge another individual is claiming moral relativism. Because what they're saying is that you can't judge another person's ideas because that might not be right for me. Whether they realize it or not, that's moral relativism. When you say, don't judge. Back a while, actually in the 60s and 70s, there was a popular advocation of one by Joseph Fletcher that he called situation ethics or situational ethics. In fact, Joseph Fletcher is considered the father of situational ethics. In his own words, what he stressed, he said, freedom from prefabricated decisions and prescriptive rules was the way to go. Okay. His idea is that you can't make up your mind in advance about what's right and wrong. You have to consider the situation. And if you lay it out in advance, that's wrong. In fact, he defined his system as being relative, non-absolute, variant, and non-universal. All the different things against what absolute morality teaches. Basically, from his point of view, the rules change. Not based on an individual or group, but on the situation as it presented. So you look at any particular situation, and then you have to make your mind what's right and what's wrong. And it's actually a form of another term that they use is called consequential morality, where right and wrong is determined by the outcome of the decision. In other words, you can't decide really whether this was a good decision or a bad decision until you see how it came out. Once you see the result of it, then you can decide, okay, that was a good decision or a bad decision. Which makes it lousy for trying to make up your mind beforehand. But what Fletcher defined his system as the relative weight of the ends and means and motives and consequences all taken together as weighed by love. So here's what his rule was. Whatever produced the greatest amount of love, that was the right decision. Of course, there's a problem here. One is, how do you define love? Are you talking about love for God? Are you talking about love for your fellow man? Or are you just talking about this fluttery feeling that's in your stomach? And of course, there's another problem too. If you're going to define this as whatever comes out with the greatest amount of love, we're talking about people. You don't know all the outcomes in advance. So what ends up happening is you have to temper this thing with your intentions to produce the greatest amount of love. You see, I don't know I think this decision is going to produce the greatest amount of love. I was really sincerely wanting this to produce the greatest amount of love, so I chose that way. Oh, it didn't work. Did I do something wrong? See, Fletcher's system says, no, that's perfectly fine. You intended to produce the greatest amount of love, so therefore, it's perfectly fine. And it says, love isn't really defined. What you really get down to, ultimately, when people tried implementing this into their lives, is that everything went by personal feelings. I made the best decision I thought of at this moment. Since I made that decision, therefore, it must be a good one. And if you think about it, what you're back to is you're back to moral relativism. You're back to saying everything changes by the person. And what's right for me might not be right for you, even if you're in the same situation. Reading through what Prager wrote, I actually found out he's been advocating this for quite a while, not just on his show. He tries to rescue situation ethics by saying that right and wrong are based on the situation, but the choice has to be based on a moral absolute. He tries to say you can have moral absolutes and situational ethics at the same time. So thus, if something is morally right, that results from a choice, then it doesn't matter what laws were broken to gain that result. And here's where one of the popular illustrations of it. He uses an illustration of a Polish woman. She used sexual favors to distract those who were looking for Jews that were hidden in her home. And so what Prager argues that, well, yes, sex outside of marriage is wrong, in this particular case, it became right because she was protecting the lives of other people. And so therefore, that sin was justified. And so what he claims that are moral absolutes, But the situation basically ends up making exceptions to the rule. And his aim is to see how God would see the situation and which choice is the one which God would make. Now there's problems with this whole idea because it plays sleight of hand with ideas. For instance, one of the things he uses as an illustration, and it illustrates this real well, he's doing a verbal sleight of hand trick with this. He points out that killing is sometimes right and sometimes wrong. Murder, which he defines as immoral killing, is wrong. But the death penalty for a condemned murderer is right. Or killing in defense of someone trying to harm yourself or harm others, that's right. He then goes and turns and claims that lying is the same thing. It can be right or wrong based on the situation. But there's a problem there. There's a huge flaw. The flaw is all murder is killing. But all killing is not murder. See, in the scriptures, and let's understand this real well, in the scriptures, murder is defined. Murder is the intentional killing of another person, either directly or indirectly, because of malice towards the victim. Take a look at Numbers chapter 35. Numbers 35, starting with verse 20. If he pushed him out of hatred or threw something at him, lying in wait, and as a result he died, or if he struck him down with his hand in enmity, and as a result he died, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. And the blood avenger shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. Okay, it's defined. There's an intent. It's not accidental. There is malice that's involved, and someone gets killed. That's murder. The Bible also defines an idea called manslaughter. It's the idea that when there's unintentional killing of another, it's defined as something different. Take a look at verse 22. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity, or threw something at him without lying in wait, or any deadly object of stone without seeing dropped it on him so that he died while he was not his enemy or seeking his injury, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to these ordinances. The congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to the city of refuge to which he fled, and he shall live in it until the death of the high priest, who was anointed with the holy oil. So here's the rule. If there was no malice, you can't prove that the guy was plotting this. It just was something that happened. It's still wrong. Killing another person still becomes a crime, but the sentence is different. But death penalties are a different class of killing. They're taking punishment for when somebody kills somebody else. So like, for instance, in Numbers chapter 35 and verse 30, it says, if anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses, but no person shall be put to death on the testimony of just one witness. Okay, there's rules. There has to be a trial. There has to be witnesses. There has to be multiple witnesses. Okay. So there had to be evidence of it. And then there was a punishment, which was death, that was brought about. That death, that punishment was not considered murder. That was judgment that was being brought about. Also in the Old Testament, defense of someone else or someone or yourself was considered appropriate. In Proverbs 24, Proverbs 24, and in verse 11, says, deliver those who are being taken away to death, and those who are staggering to slaughter. Oh, hold them back. If someone is in danger, you're supposed to intervene. That's the idea. In Exodus 22, Exodus chapter 22, and starting with verse 2, Exodus 22, verse 2, if a thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, he shall be sold for his theft. It's interesting. If someone breaks into your house in the middle of the night and you end up striking him such he dies, no problem. Why? Because you're defending your family. You're defending yourself. You don't know what that person's intent was. Now, during the daylight, something different because you can't tell whether he's got a sword or not. During the daylight, you can tell, I should say. I kind of said it backwards. But during the daylight, you can tell. And so that's, if you strike somebody down and he doesn't have any weapons in his hands, then you're guilty. At night, you can't tell. There is no guiltiness for defending your family or defending yourself. In an example of this is in Nehemiah chapter 4 of self-defense. Excuse me. Nehemiah chapter 4 and in verse 14, while they're building the walls, the workmen were to wear swords on their persons, have them available with them. Nehemiah 4, verse 14, when I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember, the Lord is great and awesome. Fight for your brothers and your sons and your daughters and your wives and your homes. Okay. There is the idea. You're supposed to protect yourself. You're supposed to protect your people. You're supposed to protect your cities. You don't just let somebody run you over because of that. So does killing change based on the situation as to whether it's right or wrong? And the answer is yes. But I want you to notice something. The criteria is based on what God said, not man. God laid out the rules. Here's the situations where this is wrong, and here's the situations when this is right. Within those criteria, it doesn't change. If there's malice in intent and somebody dies, it still is malice within the intent and somebody dies and it's still murder. It doesn't matter what the situation is. But here's where the sleight of hand comes in. Prager then takes lying and implies that it can be right or wrong. The problem is that when we look at the scriptures, lying is always defined as wrong. Take a look at Revelation 21, verse 8. Revelation 21, verse 8. It says, but for the cowardly and the unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. When is lying right? All liars end up in hell, is what is said in Revelation. Doesn't leave much room for other ones, does it? Another interesting verse is in Proverbs 12 and verse 22. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 22. lying lips are an abomination to the Lord. But those who fear are faithful, who deal faithfully, are His delight. God finds lying to be abomination. And I find that one particularly interesting because Dennis Prager wrote a very, very good article on why homosexuality is wrong. One of his key points was that it's wrong because God calls it an abomination. It cannot be made right. It is an abomination. Notice what God says about lying. It's abomination. It cannot be made right. It's something that's always disgusting. But see, what Prager does is he argues that lying sometimes is acceptable. If you say like somebody was going to murder somebody, he uses this illustration. Somebody's a murderer or a rapist is chasing somebody. You hide them in your home and the murderers come up to your doors and says, "Where is he?" And you tell them, "Well, I saw them running down the street." Not telling them that they're hiding your home. He says that lie is perfectly acceptable. There's a problem there. Lying's always wrong. I'll tell you how you handle that in a little bit. But here's the sleight of hand. He says, well, killing is sometimes right and wrong, and that's true. And then he says, okay, lying is the same thing. That's wrong. Lying is like murder. It's always wrong. If he wanted to be a fair comparison, he should have said, speech is sometimes right or wrong. And when it's lying, it's wrong. It doesn't make a fair comparison. He's not comparing two similar things. And that's why he ended up with a falsehood. See, the problem with the whole concept of making decisions based on the situation as presented at the moment is that it bases the decision on what's perceived to be the best near-term outcome. I need to decide right now what's right or what's wrong, and I got two decisions, and it looks like I got to break God's law with either one I make. And so I got to make the best outcome for right now. How many of us know the future so well? Even for the near term, let alone for the long term. In Jeremiah chapter 10, Jeremiah makes a very strong point that we've referred to numerous times. But Jeremiah chapter 10, and in verse 23, Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 23, it says, I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his steps. We don't know enough to be able to say, this is the best situation or this is the best choice. We just don't have enough information. We don't live long enough. We don't have enough experience. We have limited knowledge. We don't see everything. We might be able to guess a near-term outcome, but we definitely don't do well with long-term outcomes. Now think about it. In James chapter 1, James tells us, consider in verse 2, James 1 verse 2, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let your endurance have its perfect results so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. How many of us, when facing hardships and trials, will say, yeah, that's the way I want to go? That's the best thing for me. Most of us said, no, that's not so good. I need to pick something else. But James says there are benefits from facing trials. There's benefits from facing hardships. Not right away, but it shapes our character in the long term. Or consider the example of Paul in Acts 21. Acts 21, starting with verse 11. And coming to us, he took Paul's belt and bound it on his own hand and feet and said, "This is what the Holy Spirit says. In this way, the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles." And we heard this, we who as well as the local residents began begging him not to go up to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, "What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be bound, but even to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." And since he would not be persuaded, we fell silent, remarking, "The will of the Lord be done." Do you see what Paul's saying? Here's the situation. If you go to Jerusalem, you're going to be bound and handed over to the Jews. Everybody begs him, don't go to Jerusalem. It's obvious from this situation you're better off going someplace else, right? Paul says, well, if I have to even die, I'll do that. If that's for the Lord. But this is what I need to do. The situation looked like it was one direction, but the results are to be something different. Or ultimately consider Jesus. If you look at the near term, what good is it for an innocent person to die at the hands of men on a cross? In Matthew 26 and verse 39, Matthew 26 and verse 39, he says, and he went a little beyond them and fell on his face and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." Near term, what did Jesus rather have? Not to die. Was that the best long-term outcome? No. Yet, what we have is a system of trying to make decisions where people are saying, you have to guess what the long-term outcome is when you don't have enough information, you don't know enough, you don't know everything is going on, and somehow make the right long-term decision, even if the short-term looks like you should go a different direction. It doesn't work. If you consider when people make decisions by, they look at the near term. That's why people get themselves in trouble. Have you ever thought about, you know, for instance, just as one example, you know, why do some women put up with being beaten? A lot of times what they're doing is they're looking at the near term. And justifying to themselves that this is permissible. A lot of times when people face sins, they're looking at the near term and saying, well, I have to do this, or I had to do this. I had no other choice. They weren't looking at it from the position of God. I've used up my time already. I barely started introducing this topic. I'm going to finish this tonight. I decided to, when I was sitting down last night finishing off this lesson, I have lost the art of how to write a short sermon. But one of the things we've got to think about is when you're making decisions and when you're making choices, it depends upon God and what He wants. When men come up with their ways of making decisions, they oftentimes leave God out. And they put man in God's place. And it never works. I'll show you more of the flaws in it later this evening, but for right now, we do have a choice before you. And it's a choice of whether to put on Christ. There's a time that we can become children of God, and the time is right now. If there's anyone here who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than the present to put on Christ, to live according to His Word, because we're not guaranteed about the future. If there's anyone here who is a child of God, we'd like the prayers of the brethren on behalf. Why don't you come forth as we stand and sing the song of the selected.